It's interesting to talk about the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, but certainly peoples in the Islamic Middle East are not capable of the same. This was a conventional assumption that the Islamic Middle East somehow, because of its inherent fatalism or backwardness or whatever assumptions people had, was not capable of the same historical processes, which also saw Europe through 400 years of wars and genocides and revolutions achieve a democratic culture, one which still has many challenges, many shortcomings, but one in which people have learned in varying degrees to hold their leaders accountable. And one of the lessons of history is that absolute power brings with it absolute violence, human rights violations. So it's in that context that the issue of accountability has become a central issue in the transition of Iran from a culture characterized by authoritarianism, violence, and repression to a culture in which there is a democratic space, a space in which people can hold their leaders accountable. And as is often the case, it's a messy process, it is a complex process, it comes in fits and surges and retreats and comes back again. So we can't see through the prism of momentary political analysis of, I don't know, this week this particular political faction is prevailing over that, but we have to see it as part of a wider historical awakening. I spent most of my career dealing with the suffering of other people in Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Guatemala, Cambodia. I could go on and on about a career spanning mass atrocities, authoritarian cultures characterized by massive systematic violence, trying to reckon with the past. But it's always different when you deal with your own country. It's always different because the stakes are much higher. And no matter how much we like to think that we're universalists and we are human rights advocates that are concerned with the plight of all without discrimination, which we are, I suppose, at a certain point. But I suppose there is a different responsibility that one has. And when it implicates your own personal history, the loss of loved ones, then, of course, the responsibility becomes that much greater. So by way of background, in this context, and in the context in which the notion of power is being redefined, in particular by unlikely actors such as the mothers of Khavaran, the mothers of Lalepar, mothers who have lost their children to torture, executions, who now, as mothers would, are demanding justice, are demanding accountability, and who in a sense have nothing to lose. When a mother loses her child, what does she have to lose? And it's very easy when we reduce the world to political analysis of, okay, it's faction X and faction Y today, it's the presidency, it's the majlis, and you know, the kind of analysis which policymakers usually are concerned with, to completely diminish the significance of civil society, but more significantly, a group such as the Mothers of Khavaran. And I will explain, Khavaran was the mass grave where thousands of political prisoners who were executed were unceremoniously dumped, which the regime until recently never even admitted took place, and where mothers for many years were being arrested simply for laying flowers and saying prayers and trying to mourn their dead. So we think here about the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, and we begin to reconceptualize the notion of power. Well, here we're talking about the power of a mourning mother who has lost her child and who in effect has nothing to lose, who will go to any lengths to achieve justice. Some time ago, when I was giving a talk in Canada, Toronto, we call it now Tehranto, so many Iranians there have taken over. We're going to annex it very soon. And I had a mother approach me, and she said, may I speak to you? She was very deferential, you know, Iranians, when they see someone who's a professor, you know, janab-e doktor, you know, professors are important people. So may I speak to you? She was very shy, very reluctant to impose on my time. And I said, I'd be happy to speak to you. She said, and told me, I've lost my son.
can you help me? And when you think about those words, I've lost my son, she said it so politely with such deference. So you think about a mother in a shopping mall whose child is lost, who's saying, I've lost my son, can you please help me? But she had lost her son. Her son had been tortured to death, in effect, in Karizak as a result of the events of 2009. And that simple question, me, the professor of law, the international prosecutor, and all of that, being confronted with a mother who says, can you help me? And I'm faced with the situation of telling her, well, I really can't help you because I can't take your case to a court. And this was her assumption, that surely you as the professor of law and as the Hague prosecutor, you can help little me get some measure of justice for my child. So that kind of very intimate account with injustice, the injustice of a mother who's lost her child, and the inability, as a renowned expert and all the other things you kindly said, but which ultimately become very futile because you realize that how can you possibly redeem the loss of this woman in front of you? And it's no longer a statistic of 800,000 in Rwanda and 200,000 in Bosnia and institution building in The Hague, but the story of one mother who has lost her child and a mother who's broken for life, who will never be put together again. So it was the case that during the course of my activities on Iran, many people approached me who had lost their loved ones in the 1980s. And if we look at modern contemporary Iranian history, irrespective of what political ideology or view or preference we have, it's safe to say that the first decade of the Islamic Revolution from 1979 till around 1989 is probably, I would say, almost certainly, by far the bloodiest. And there are various reasons for that. There was the time of the Iran-Iraq War, it was the upheaval of the overthrow of the monarchy, and one could analyze it from many points of view. I'm not a scholar of Iranian history, so I'm not even going to try to provide some kind of explanation because it's really unnecessary. But the fact is that during that period, there were, by, I would say, conservative estimates, at least 20,000 executions from around 1979 till 1988, which was the consummation of this decade of violence, as the regime began with the summary execution of the leaders of the monarchy and then moved from there to Kurdish leaders, to leaders of the Baha'i community, and then the erstwhile allies, which included the Mujahideen organization, various different leftist organizations, the different factions of the Islamists, turned on each other. And the largest number of executions actually took place against some of the political groups on the political left, broadly speaking, who had at one point been allied to the regime. And by 1981 or thereabouts, with the ouster of President Bani Sadr and a whole lot of other events which are very complex, the executions had reached a different threshold in terms of their volume, in terms of their systematicity. And we had, of course, in the first few months of the revolution, a lot of executions that took place in the midst of chaos. Chaos and random militia being able to round up people and execute them. But by 1981, this had become a systematic sort of Stalinist reign of terror to execute people who were either guilty of some political crime or who were potentially guilty. And it didn't really matter, because as long as you instill fear and terror in people, sometimes through random executions, you've achieved your objective of consolidating power. And once again, I'm not an expert in Iranian history, but I could give you 10 different examples from countries that I've dealt with which have the exact same ingredients of sort of consolidation of authoritarian power. So the 81 period ultimately was consummated, if you like, in 1988, at the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And of course, there's a whole other discussion about the war of aggression, what began as a war of aggression on Iran, supported by foreign powers, including the United States and the Europeans, in very cynical game of divide and rule, that actually helped turn both the Islamic Republic and Saddam Hussein's Iraq into the monstrous entities that they eventually became, as opposed to weakening them, which was the sort of thinking. That's a whole other discussion. But in the context of the Iran-Iraq war, in which an estimated 500,000 people were killed, a war that dragged on because it served various political interests, in 1988, when it became clear that Iran had to conclude a peace agreement with Iraq, that it was not possible to overthrow Saddam Hussein and establish a Shiite republic, President George W. Bush was going to do that for the Iranians sometime later. Then, as Khomeini said, he drank the chalice of poison, concluded the peace agreement. In the midst of that atmosphere, there was a fatwa issued by Ayatollah Khomeini to execute pretty much the entire population of political prisoners. By some accounts, these political prisoners are so-called munafiqin, or the religious hypocrites, the idea that they were Muslims, but in fact hypocrites because their belief was not genuine, were rounded up, and in trials, which aren't really trials, more an inquisition, often lasting 1 or 2 minutes, in which people were basically asked whether they subscribe to the Islamic Republic, whether they're devout Muslims, very basic questions reminiscent of the Spanish Inquisition, basically inquiring about people's religious faith. People were, based on a yes or no answer, taken to an amphitheater and hanged. And it is estimated that between 4,000 and 5,000 people were executed in the span of a few weeks in the summer of 1988. And I refer to this as Iran's Srebrenica, Srebrenica referring to the Bosnian enclave in which some 8,000 Bosnian Muslims are rounded up and executed, which was in a sense the consummation of this systematic violence against the Bosnian Muslims, which found its, if you like, height or depth, depending on how you look at it, in that one incident. So 1988 becomes a very definitive moment in Iran's culture of violence. Now, why is it important? It's important because it symbolizes a much wider culture of political violence, which to this day afflicts the Iranian people as they try to find a better path for a better future. What is the problem? The problem is impunity. The problem is that the regime executed all of these people in secret. Unlike the early executions in the early days of the regime, where the figure of the former monarchists who were executed was paraded for all to see, was announced openly in the newspapers. And the regime, as I explained, dumped these bodies in a cemetery in a road called Khavaran, towards the south of Tehran. And that is why Khavaran has become a symbol for so many things that have gone wrong in the recent history of Iran. Now, what is the issue? Some would say, well, this is all from 1988. Who cares? That's so far in the past. What difference does it make? Let's concentrate on more recent events. But the culture of impunity and the culture of rewarding violence is a culture which explains exactly why we have the problems that we have in Iran in many respects. Now, what do we mean by culture of impunity? Culture of impunity, getting back to the basic idea of human rights accountability, basically means that those who commit atrocities not only go unpunished, of course they're unpunished because it's a fatwa of Ayatollah Khomeini, it's the policy of the head of state to execute en masse 5,000 political prisoners without anything barely resembling a fair trial. It characterizes the way in which power and legitimacy is defined. And if you look at the various characters that were involved in the so-called death commissions, these were three-member commissions that sat in the various prisons in Iran, singling out who would be executed or not. And if you look at the members of those death commissions, one of them ended up becoming the Minister of Justice, Mr. Shushtari. Another ended up becoming the Minister of Interior, Mr. Pur Mohammadi. And these names are actually included in the fatwa of Ayatollah Khomeini, where he specifically names these individuals as those who would sit on the death commission and decide who would be hanged and who would not. One of them is the Deputy Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Iran. And one could go on and on with this sort of who's who of those that earned power by virtue of their complicity in these crimes. So it was a rite of passage, in effect, that you prove your worthiness. And we see the same thing today. Said Mortazavi, the notorious butcher of the press, who recently was jailed and then released, who's part of this power struggle now between the Ahmadinejad clan and the Larijani clan and all of these power struggles. Well, we know what he did to Zahra Kazemi, who died of vicious torture and rape under his authority at Evin prison. And if you really do a kind of biographical sketch of many of those in the inner circle, you will see that they have earned their positions of power by virtue of participation in violence. So when you look at that reality, you realize, okay, well, we want to build a different political culture. We don't want to just shift power, have one group of butchers replace another group of butchers and call it a revolution of change, but we really want to change how those in power, irrespective of their ideology, they could be monarchist, Islamist, secularist, leftist, it doesn't matter, because we know from history that abuse is abuse. The victim of a torture is a victim of torture. You can rationalize it by all sorts of ideological, political accounts, but at the end of the day, the notion of human rights is we don't ask what your ideology is before deciding whether you should or should not be tortured. We believe that there are absolute rules in terms of how we treat people. I, for one, was heavily criticized by many of my Iranian friends when I was an amicus before the U.S. Supreme Court in the case of Yasser Hamdi versus Donald Rumsfeld, which dealt with the rights of a Guantanamo Bay detainee, member of the Taliban, and the question of whether he had rights under the Geneva Conventions. So that is the basic lesson that we have to understand. First, that human rights means that you have rights because you're a human being. And a culture of hatred, violence, conspiracy theories, smearing of opponents, rationalizing this sort of mass atrocities is absolutely at odds with creating any sort of non-violent democratic space, as is a culture of impunity. Impunity understood in the most basic sense as a kind of imposed amnesia, where people are not even aware of what crimes have occurred. So with that rather lengthy introduction, I want to explain how the Iran Tribunal came about and then see a little clip of the testimony of the victims and then to have just some final concluding remarks. Some time back, the families of the victims and survivors of the 1980s massacres, who came from very different groups, and many of them had profound political disagreements with each other. The fact that they could actually put their disagreements aside and find a common platform itself was a very powerful example of how in Iran, human rights is becoming, in some respects, sort of the glue that is keeping otherwise antagonistic groups, I wouldn't say together, but increasingly it is becoming a shared platform between people with many different ethnic, religious, political, and other persuasions, especially in the new generation, which calls for nonviolence, which calls for a culture of dialogue. And these groups, once again, as many others, like that mother I give you the example of, asked me, can we take Iran to the International Criminal Court for the 1988 mass execution? And of course, once again, I had to tell them, I'm sorry, but Iran has not recognized the statute of the International Criminal Court, and it would have jurisdiction anyways because the crimes occurred prior to 2002 when the court's temporal jurisdiction begins. Typical professorial answer, but they were not willing to accept this. They said, but we have to do something. So the idea emerged, well, when international courts fail, the topic of today's lecture, let's make our own court. Why not make our own court? Interesting idea. Now, we know that in 1966, Bertrand Russell set up the so-called Russell Tribunal with, I forget now, my mind has just gone blank, Jean-Paul Sartre, of course. And these intellectuals basically scrutinized American war crimes in Vietnam and created this sort of informal justice in order to condemn America's atrocities during the Vietnam War. So many people were inspired by the Russell model. They said, well, we'll create a people's tribunal. But this was different because the Russell Tribunal were a set of intellectuals. And yes, they were progressive, they were condemning the atrocities of the Vietnam War, but they weren't really victims, they weren't really survivors, they weren't directly implicated in the way that these families were. So this was, for me, a fascinating example of grassroots justice, justice from below. People saying that if the United Nations is going to fail us, if the world doesn't care because they have no political interest in dealing with this, well, we're not going to just be victims and despair. We're going to take matters into our own hands, and we are going to create our own informal justice. This discussion itself for me was fascinating. I think I learned so much through this process of dealing at ground zero with victims and trying to understand what justice means to them. Well, it meant different things. Some of them said, we want Mr. X to be prosecuted and end up in prison, and nothing short of that will satisfy us. And Mr. X would be, let's say, a very prominent political figure. Someone else would say, I want my next door neighbor who betrayed me to be punished, because to me it doesn't matter what the president or prime minister or whoever did, because for me it's a question of personal betrayal. Yet someone else would say, I just want to tell my story. I want to heal, because for 30 years, every day, this has been eating away at me like a cancer. And I need a catharsis. I need a space in which I can share this with the Iranian people, with the wider public, with the wider community. So each of them had very different ideas about what justice represents for them. So when I looked at this, I said, some of these can be achieved without formal justice. Some of this can be achieved without a defendant in the dock. So at the end, we created some combination of a truth commission and quasi-judicial process. A truth commission was held in London in June of last year, in which about 80 witnesses, some of whom we'll see, came and told their harrowing, harrowing stories. This was broadcast by satellite television by a number of different broadcasters, not just BBC and Voice of America, but most significantly, Manoto Television, which is what young people in Iran watch because it's entertaining. How many people watch BBC if you can see something with, celebrity gossip and all of that? So we had an extraordinary coverage of this testimony, and we estimate that maybe 20, 25 million people in Iran who had never heard of that first bloody decade of the revolution, which is presented to them as a glorious golden age, understood the DNA of political violence which characterizes the Islamic Republic today. They understood the seeds of power built on terror and violence and mass executions and impunity. So the second stage, which was in The Hague in October, was less of a truth commission. Truth commission, as in South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is important because it allows a significant number of people to come and tell their stories. This tribunal was all based on voluntary donations. We all worked voluntarily, but there were costs of travel and other things. Some of the people who had lost their family members mortgaged their homes to be able to raise funds to fly in the commissioners, which included prominent academics like Bill Shavis, one of the great scholars of international criminal law, John Dugard, South African member of the International Law Commission, Michael Mansfield. Those of you who are in the legal circles in London will know his prominence here as a Queen's Counsel, also the former UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights. So they were quite credible individuals. And The Hague was more a kind of quasi-judicial process of taking the testimony of about 100 witnesses and transforming it into some sort of legal conclusion. We sent a letter to the Islamic Republic of Iran's embassy in The Hague, inviting them to participate, knowing fully well that they would probably say no, but we still invited them. And then we did what international courts do, which is to have basically a default judgment, but nonetheless, with the presentation of evidence, with the presentation of legal argument, and with scrutiny by an eminent panel of judges, included prominent members such as Makau Mutua, member of the Kenyan Truth Commission, people who have no stake in the sort of Iranian fight, if you like. And of course, the precedent for that is the case brought by Nicaragua against the United States in 1984, during the time when the CIA was trying to overthrow the Sandinistas. The U.S. did not show up after it lost on jurisdiction, but the International Court of Justice went ahead, rendered its judgment, and as is the case in default judgments, it took into account some of the arguments that could have been raised had the United States been the respondent in order to ensure that the judgment is a reasonably balanced judgment. Having said that, I'm just going to say one last thing as an introduction to this film. Many, many people have written volumes of books and artistic productions trying to recount their experiences of the mass atrocities in the 1980s. One thing that I've learned, and I just gave a talk just before this for the Public International Law Group, about how we use the medium of language, which is a very rationalistic discourse, in order to convey the intensity of human suffering. One thing I've learned from Rwanda to Bosnia, and now my own home country of Iran, is that the voices of victims speak with a power that no professor, no bureaucrat, no head of state, whatever, could ever possibly replicate. There's an incredible power in a mother, as was the case, coming and sitting at the witness table in front of a room of 400 people with a photograph of her four children and explaining one by one how each of her children were arrested and executed. And one of the things that we forget when we talk about statistics, 5,000 here, 20,000 there, whatever the case may be, what is the saying that a single murder is a tragedy, a million murders is a statistic? One of the things that we forget is that behind every victim, there is a name. There is a mother, a father, a brother, a sister, a husband, a wife, and so on and so forth. And only then do we understand how this violence spreads throughout society. It's not just a question of 5,000 victims or 20,000 victims. It's a question of for every one victim, 100 other people are profoundly affected. And this trauma is in need of healing if Iranian nation is going to move forward. We have a traumatized nation, a nation that's been traumatized by violence and now sadly traumatized by sanctions and threats of war and all sorts of other things, which have just created a culture of such stress and violence that if we do not have a catharsis, if we do not have an outlet, we don't have a process of healing, the prospect that our political change is going to be violent will be that much greater. So the point here is not vengeance. The point is justice. The point here is not to drag up past crimes in order to rationalize violence. But on the contrary, you cannot expect someone who's lost their loved one to forget it. You cannot just tell them, shut up, keep silent, forget about it, we've moved on. That's not the way it works. That person has to be given at least some measure of recognition, some measure of accountability. But what's unique here, not only is it the fact that this is a victim-driven judicial process, but also that it is transitional justice before the transition. We don't really have a transitional situation in Iran. We have a kind of maybe remote possibility of a transition. But it's clearly not what we had in South Africa, where we had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission post-apartheid. So it is really remarkable, and I would invite you to study it, as scholars of transitional justice, democratic transitions. And my hope is that this example, which begins largely with the families of leftist political prisoners, would expand to embrace other victim groups as well, to underline exactly the point that it's not the identity of the victim that matters, but it's the fact of victimization. And that is the alpha and omega of any hope that the Iranian people can have in building a culture of human rights, in which your human rights are not conditioned on whether your ideology or religion is or is not acceptable. So with that in mind, I share with you one last story, which you will understand once you see the power of the victim's testimony rather than my lecture here, which is that in one moment, that mother came to the front of the room, started telling the story of her children. This is Shahla, this is Shahram. He was studious, she was mischievous. The way a mother talks about her children. And then one by one, he was arrested on this day. They gave me his body back on that day. She was hanged on this day, and so on. And so just harrowing, harrowing stories. And as she started telling the story, she began to weep. Tears started streaming from her eyes. And I looked at the room, and I saw that the whole room was weeping with her. 300-400 people in the room. To my right-hand side was someone who was, I don't know, a dedicated Marxist. To my left-hand side was someone who was a dedicated monarchist. In the back of the room were some people who were supporters of the Green Movement. And there was a Kurd and a Baluch and a Jew and a Muslim. And it was just extraordinary to see one moment in this deeply divided society where nobody trusts anybody, that for one moment there was a shared humanity. For one moment, people set aside their hatreds, their mistrust, their conflict, and they just shared in the grief of a mother who's lost her children. No one asked, "I'm sorry, madam, but were your children Baha'is or Mujahideen or Muslims?" And it didn't matter. So I want you to just bear that in mind, that as you see the witness testimony, there were quite a few people in that room from totally different beliefs and walks of life, and that this was being broadcast and beamed for millions of people to see in Iran, and that it is really part of the process of building a new culture, a culture in which there is a transcendent and shared humanity, which can hopefully show people different possibilities than what they've encountered historically. So with that very short introduction, maybe we can see this. And I always apologize after showing those clips because it's very painful and it's with reluctance. But I think that you understand now why I think there is a certain power in the voice of the victims, and there is a certain power in the grief of a mother who has nothing to lose, who will go to any lengths to have some measure of redemption in the face of irredeemable loss. I just wanted, in wrapping up the discussion, just share some further reflections. One is the remarkable bond between the mothers of Khavaran and the mothers of Lollipark, who are the mothers who lost their children in the 2009 violence. And it's quite intriguing. I had many contacts with the mothers of Lollipark. They interviewed me about this tribunal, and we had a number of exchanges. And it's just quite extraordinary in the midst of that incredibly violent, divided political culture to have this force which transcends different decades in Iran's recent history, transcends different political divides, and once again it goes to that shared humanity and that process of healing, without which you have to ask, you know, how can you ignore what has happened and go on to build a better future? It's like someone who's been severely traumatized wants to be a psychologically balanced and normal person rather than going home and beating his wife and children because of unresolved trauma. One could understand it in many ways to arrive at the conclusion that as painful as this is, it has to be dealt with. It can't just be repressed, swept under the carpet. And many people were very critical of me. Many people in the human rights community said, this is not the time to be doing this because it implicates some of the people who are now part of the reformist camp. My question is, when is it the right time? Will it ever be the right time? And on the contrary, if we don't have this outlet and catharsis, then the prospect of revenge and violence will be that much greater. So to me, this is not about sort of political instrumentalization of past atrocities to try and discredit particular individuals, which is why I didn't name any names. It's not about encouraging violence and revenge, but it's about recognizing that this deep wound is there, and it's a national wound. It's not just the wound of that mother, it's the wound of an entire nation, which still suffers from having failed to address this tremendous period of violence. Which brings me to the fact that when we talk about justice, when we see the mother Esma, this amazing woman who, in the simplicity of her voice, spoke with such power, we see that it's about redeeming your humanity. We see some of the literature on trauma, whether it's the South African Truth Commission, the Mothers Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, that justice, whether it's a truth commission, whether it's a museum, whether it is any number of other means of reckoning with the past, is a means by which someone whose humanity has been shattered re-enters into humanity through the medium of language, through the medium of this sort of shared space. So, of course, you see the incredible story of the mother whose 11-year-old nephew was executed, who lost her entire family. It's just beyond comprehension. But still, somehow, getting back to the issue of what justice means for her, she says, before I died, I just wanted to tell my story. I wanted people to hear my story, and I feel that I've unburdened myself. So when we think about that, we see that it's in a sense she's reclaiming a bit of her humanity. But the untold story here is that of the perpetrators. What about the perpetrators? And if we're talking about reconciliation, national reconciliation in Iran, is it not the case also that the torturer also denies his humanity as much as he denies the humanity of the victim? And one of the very powerful scenes, I didn't want to give you 1 hour of different footage, I saw what you saw, I saw 100 witnesses go through that. Let me tell you, it took me a long time to recover after that. But one of the two incidents I wanted to mention to you, just so that you understand that justice, accountability, healing is also about redeeming the humanity of the torturers. All those that were brainwashed and convinced that, yeah, hanging an 11-year-old child is right, it is righteous. It will give you divine benedictions. Just think, what does it take to hang an 11-year-old child? So, two stories. One was a courageous man from Sweden, refugee from Sweden, a so-called tawwab. These were those that in prison were forced to repent and participate in the execution of fellow prisoners as a way of redeeming themselves and then being released from prison. This man explained how as a 16-year-old child, he was basically put in a room in front of a wall and in a kind of what is called a human coffin. It's a special torture technique. For hours and hours and days, they filled his ears with the propaganda of the Islamic Republic until he was convinced that he had been wrong because of his political activities. And many of the executions occurred because a 16-year-old had a political pamphlet in his pocket or something like that. We're not even talking about those that engaged in terrorist acts. And of course, even as I explained the case of, you know, the Taliban in Guantanamo Bay, no matter what the perpetrator has done, this doesn't justify execution and torture, certainly not without a fair trial. And an 11-year-old child and a 15-year-old child, probably not executed because of terrorism. It was this as we say in Persian, creation of terror, terrorizing people into showing that the regime is so cruel and ruthless that resistance is futile. So in this particular case, this tawwab came and testified about how he had something which we call tire khalas, when you want to make sure that people are actually dead, you go with a gun and you shoot them in the head at point blank range after the execution. And he explained how as a 16-year-old child, he had done that. And he was the most courageous of all the witnesses because he was sitting in the same room as the mother whose 4 children were killed in that way. And in front of her, he was apologizing. He was begging for forgiveness. He was saying, I wish they had killed me. I wish they had killed me because I need to live every day of my life with the realization of what I've done to your children. It's those moments that are powerful, that show you the power of reconciliation and healing. Or the man who belonged to the Hojatiye society, who was responsible for attacking and burning the homes of Baha'is. I myself am from the Baha'i minority. My uncle, Dr. Naimi, was tortured to death in Hamadan in 1981. He was an expert in malaria. So this man from the Hojatia heard the testimony of Rui Jahanpour, a woman Baha'i from Shiraz, who was in the prison with 10 other women, one of them 16-year-old Mona Mahmoud Najat, who was hanged for teaching children's classes to Baha'i children that were expelled from school because they were considered filthy infidels who did not have the right to education. And after Ruhi's testimony, this man came weeping to her and begged for forgiveness. So those are also glimpses of a different side of the equation. It's not just the victims, but it's also the perpetrators, those that were brainwashed and instrumentalized so that others could abuse power and reap the benefits. Just to end, one of the great successes of this tribunal was that recently, 2 months ago, in Baztal, which is a very well-known website, close to certain circles in the regime, there was a remarkable article, which for the first time, 25 years, admitted that indeed there had been a fatwa, that many people had been executed, and what is most significant in this masterful piece of Orwellian propaganda was that Ayatollah Khamenei, the current supreme leader, was portrayed as a human rights champion that defied the authority of Imam Khomeini, then the supreme leader. And of course, the idea that Imam would defy his fatwa is absolutely ridiculous given the context, but he was turned into the human rights champion that saved thousands of lives by resisting further executions, which is, of course, an admission not only that the executions took place, but that they were wrong, which shows, once again, the power of having broadcast the testimony of Mother Esmat and all these other people to millions of people, which shows that it is possible to speak truth to power, and that even the most seemingly untouchable leaders have, at some point, to account for what they've done. I'm going to stop there and simply say that, especially to those of you who are the younger generation of Iranians and human rights activists, to say that this is really not the end, it's just the beginning. And it's up to us to assume responsibility and to build this new culture from the bottom up if we are to have any hope of putting this dark past behind us. And my hope is that this dialogue will only become greater and with time increasingly transcend all the divisions of religion and politics and identity and whatever, what have you. And I was recently in Brazil on the eve of the Rio Plus 20 conference. In order to speak to Brazilian decision makers and media on the eve of President Ahmadinejad's visit, because Brazil has very warm ties with Iran, and much of the Brazilian public doesn't know about these things. So I was talking to the Brazilians, and of course they have a kind of a left-wing government, many of whom were former political prisoners. Lula, the great president of Brazil, who's one of my heroes, was a man who was living on the streets as a kind of, as a child, he was cleaning people's shoes, then he ended up being a metal worker in a shop, then he became a workers' party sort of activist, and during the military junta in 1980, he was put in prison, and then he became the president. And we have Dilma Rousseff, the president. She was also, you know, a Marxist guerrilla who was put in prison and tortured, and now she's the president. So the point is not that I'm a Marxist, or that's not the point, but I'm just saying it's remarkable to see a society in which a woman who was a former political prisoner and torture victim now becomes the president in democratic elections. And we should also think that the time will also come for the Iranians. Because if you told someone in the 1980s under the military junta in Brazil that this political prisoner will become your future president, they would say you're absolutely insane. So maybe the day will come that Nasrin Sotoudeh will become the democratically elected president of Iran. The day will come when this truth commission will take place in Tehran and Shiraz and Esfahan and on the site. And many of those people that don't have the courage to come forward now will come forward to unburden themselves, victims and perpetrators. And maybe the day will come when, like Auschwitz and Tul Slang in Cambodia, Evin prison will finally become Evin museum. So all the school children can go and see the photographs and read the stories of the horrors and ensure that we never have to revisit this darkness again. Thank you very much. I'm sorry if I went up for so long.